Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. Today we have Ryan Holiday joining us. Hey, Ryan, how are you?
I'm really good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Really appreciate it. You and I met, what was it, like 2-3 years ago? You're helping me with the marketing of my book.
Yeah.
Yeah. You blew my mind at that point. I was not in this industry, and your insights into marketing and how this industry works. I remember somebody saying you guys were like the Napsters of the the book publishing world. I thought that was perfect. So your latest book, The Ego is the Enemy, came out, and I've been reading, checking it out. Completely blown away by the video that you put up on YouTube, Fight Mediocrity. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody out there who hasn't heard it, you've just got to check it out. So heartfelt, Ryan. Tell me about the video, the story behind the video, this new chapter in your life. It's a real shift from I think, you know, your previous works.
Yeah, I think that's actually the audiobook intro of the book that he then animated. So one of the interesting things as I sat down to write a book about ego was sort of this decision artistically, should I be in the book or not? And I really didn't want to be in the book. I wanted the book to be about the ideas, like the idea that, you know, ego is a sort of destructive force, the way we make things all about ourselves, the way we sort of project our identity onto things sort of prevents us from doing some of the work that we need to do or doing it as sort of authentically and, you know, vulnerably as we might want to do. So that was the idea for the book. And every time I would come back with a draft, my editor sort of said, but you're not in the book and you have to be in the book. And so the intro was sort of my attempt to sort of explain, because I'd sat down to write a book about ego sort of before some stuff had happened to me. And then sort of as I was writing this book, American Apparel, where I'd been the director of marketing, more or less imploded, sort of evaporating, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of shareholder value. And my mentor, who had been Doug Charney, who was the founder of the company, sort of lost everything. Another company that I'd been a part of sort of collapsed around the same time. I was sort of thrown by all of this. I was working more than I'd ever worked before. I was experiencing a lot of success, but also deeply sort of unhappy with it. And so it's just sort of a, you know, what happens when you want to be like someone and then you realize one day you don't want to be anything like them. And I think on top of that, when if you've had mentors in your life, you'll often hear this like, oh, they see something of themselves in me. And so it's this sort of wake up call where you realize, oh, wait, I don't want whatever they see in me to be true. I don't want to end up like these people. So it was just sort of a big wake up call for me that sort of coincided with a lot of the research that I was doing for the book. It's sort of my rock bottom moment is where the book basically begins.
Interesting. And you say also in that video that there's like a newsreel of like success that you put forward of all the highlights, right? But like,
sure,
people don't talk about the cost, and that there was also this cost that you were paying while the people around you weren't what they appeared to be. And those mentors, you know, the image was slipping away, things were difficult. But then with yourself, you weren't necessarily putting that narrative out there, and that people choose to show successful narratives as this, you know, fame and fortune. And it's just amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look, I think anyone that's ever had to write a quick bio of themselves because they're giving a talk or they're joining a charity or they're even, you know, just applying for a job, you realize that this sort of truncated version of your personal history is massively inaccurate, right? It only shows the good things.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's very hard to encapsulate your life in 3 or 4 sentences without deliberately omitting a lot of things. And so, you know, as someone who got successful relatively early, or relatively successful relatively early, you know, I noticed that, and I saw people who were experiencing some of the same things as me sort of buy into this sort of bio version of themselves. And so that's something I've always thought a lot about. It's like, okay, if I have to write, you know, my bio for the back of my book, how can I do it in a way that looks best, but also deceives myself the least, right? It's like sort of, you know, as a marketer, you constantly have this battle of, you know, how do I make this thing appealing, but how do I also maintain a sort of a ruthless objectivity about the quality of my own work? So if you don't do that, you're not going to get any better.
Yeah, no, it makes a ton of sense. And you don't want to put out there, like for myself, I built a business, you know, we were the gold standard in our space. and I was taking Ambien, right? So how do you add in the realities without sounding like you've lost it? Because I know a lot of successful people, and there's a huge price. There's a huge cost to that success. It can be very hard on yourself.
So, I mean, it's like you look at an Instagram feed. You don't take pictures of things that are unappealing, but you have to remember what happens between the photographs.
Yep, absolutely, right? So ego is the enemy. Before we jump in, you have a very specific view of ego. Ego is talked about in MySpace, like crazy, Eckhart Tolle, all these people. So before we jump in, could you just give a quick definition of how you see ego, how you define it, as opposed to maybe psychologists or some of the other people out in the space?
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, not being a psychologist, I don't want to pretend that I have some sort of scientific or medical diagnosis or prognosis. Like, I'm talking about ego in the sort of most colloquial, basic sense. Like, you know, I guess you would say I'm referring to ego in the sort of the Donald Trump sense, the sort of over self-absorption, selfishness, delusion, self-importance, you know, overconfidence. I'm talking about ego in the, you know, that person's being a real asshole kind of sense. And so I think we all, it's really interesting to say, is to see how often we accuse other people of being egotistical, even though we know we have a lot of those traits in our own lives. And so that's sort of what I'm referring to. I'm not referring it to the Freudian sense, which honestly, I probably don't even understand. I'm referring it to the colloquial sort of arrogance kind of definition of ego.
Got it. And when you say like arrogance, ego, how do you think about ego in terms of having a general sense of confidence and belief in yourself versus insecurity? Like, how do you balance that as well?
Well, I think confidence is really important, right? And one of the things that I ended up working on in the book or thinking about is, you know, Aristotle has this concept of the golden mean, where he basically says that, you know, every virtue is a midpoint between two virtues. And so basically, you know, you might say that confidence is sort of halfway between, you know, arrogance and say like crippling self-doubt. So I'm actually saying confidence is great. Ego is confidence without basis, or ego is sort of confidence that's sort of turned sour. There's plenty of things for people to be confident about. I think ego is when our sort of sense of self starts to outpace that confidence. And in a weird way, often I find that sort of crippling self-doubt is in its own way sort of a kind of self-absorption, right? It's this sort of sense of, oh, it's impossible. I know that it's impossible. You don't know what you're talking about. You know, it's interesting, like if you were to try to talk to an egotistical person and try to convince them of some sort of clear, you know, pretty uncontroversial reality, you'd have a lot of trouble. By the same token, if you were trying to convince a depressed person to get off the couch and go put themselves out in the world and do something, you'd experience almost a similar level of resistance. This sort of, you don't know what you're talking about. It's not worth it. It's totally unfair. It'll never happen. I'm not any good at that. So to me, they're sort of both sides of the same coin, and confidence is probably somewhere in the middle.
Interesting. Yeah, because that overwhelming self-doubt can start to spiral into a narrative within yourself that is feeding your ego, and it's getting lost in yourself, right? Is that what you're...
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a reason that a lot of people who are not successful also have a sort of very strong sense of superiority, right? This is how they justify a lot of that sort of bitterness or anger that they feel, is projecting it outwards of, oh, that person's full of it, or that person's a liar, or they cheated, they're not as good as me. You know, I'm talking about ego as both being toxic if you're an ambitious person, but you know, a full third of the book is the way that ego has an insidious effect on us when we're experiencing adversity or failure. Like when you're at rock bottom, ego is particularly bad because, you know, here ego sort of whispering in your ear like, you really are worthless, you know, you really did deserve this, or it really is impossible, or you should just quit, or everyone's laughing at you. You know, this sort of idea that you're the center of the universe is sort of a very unpleasant reality, whether things are going really well or whether things are going really poorly.
Yeah. And I mean, this is something that I'm, you know, focused my work on, but these narratives, these imposter thoughts, the thoughts that we have in our head, not to take them as always the truth and something that you need to listen to all day long. How do you suggest somebody manage those thoughts as they're derailing, you know,
yeah, their goals? I mean, I think, look, part of it is just getting out of your head entirely, right? I think these sort of inner monologues that we're running all the time are oftentimes sort of used as an excuse to not do something. It's like, I have to, you're either thinking it all the way through, or you're obsessing on how amazing it's going to go, or conversely, you're afraid to think about it, so you think about all these other unrelated things, or you're obsessing on how poorly it's going to go, when really, if you could sort of, you know, sort of hit pause and just try, sort of lose yourself in the work itself, you'd probably find that a lot of those things you're thinking about sort of work themselves out. So I think, you know, ego tends, again, to be obsessing with itself. And I think one of the best ways to stop that is to sort of be lost in that flow state. I think it's interesting, you know, you look at someone like Kanye West, clearly is sort of this malignant, toxic ego, which causes a lot of problems for himself. I imagine one of the few places where that doesn't exist is when he's making music. And I don't think it could exist when he was making music for him to have made the things that he's made. So you could argue that I think that sort of flow state where you're lost in the work, you're being creative, you're entirely in the present, you're sort of vulnerable, you're exploring your feelings, you're, you know, sort of taking risks and doing things. This is where ego really just sort of mysteriously disappears.
Yeah. So finding your talents, finding the thing that you love, and allowing yourself to just do the work and not
totally
think about the outcomes and the fame, the fortune, or what other people think, or all of that stuff, right? Hard to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, look, I talked about Nick Saban, the football coach of the University of Alabama, in my last book. And you know, one of the things that it's sort of central to his sort of work as a coach. And there's a lot of ego in college football and football in general. But, you know, he's saying basically, you know, the average down in football lasts for like 7 seconds. He's like, that's all I really want you to be thinking about is those 7 seconds. If you can do a really good job in those 7 seconds every time, like, we're going to be a good football team. Yeah. He's like, I don't want you to be thinking about the national championship. I don't want you to be thinking about, you know, if this is the third game of the season, I don't even want you to be thinking about the fourth quarter of that game if we're in the second quarter. I want you to think about right now what you're supposed to do in this moment. He calls this the process. And I think if you focus on the process, it tends to be an antidote to ego in a lot of ways.
Ryan, but talk to me about this, because, you know, I'm 45, I'm older than you are, but same thing. When I was younger, it was like, suck it up, man up. I hear you, the 20-year-olds, it's always heads down, like, because you guys are in your computers, set epic goals, heads down, push through, no excuses. Isn't this like counter to what you're saying? Because I find this whole concept, it flies in the face of finding that flow state, because when you set like insane goals and then you push yourself to just heads down all the time and you're yelling at yourself to work harder, doesn't that kick up the ego?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is what I'm not saying to do that at all. Nick Saban is saying, don't focus on a national championship. Focus on doing the immediate task in front of you really, really well, and be content to that sort of micro level of excellence. And then sort of the rest of it kind of takes care of itself. So yeah, I think in a lot of ways, these sort of, I need to have this ambitious goal to change the world, is actually really counterproductive. Paul Graham, who's probably the greatest investor in the Silicon Valley and one of the greatest essayists, coincidentally, he talks about this. He's like, one of the ways for a startup, you know, sort of to do really big things, he says counterintuitively, is to start with really small things. You know, Uber didn't think it was going to be this transportation company that changes the whole world. It was like, look, I don't want to take a cab and I'm not going to rent a limo. How can I get like access to a black car on my phone? It's like, how can I start at a really small level? You know, I don't think you set out and you go, hey, I want to write a book that's going to sell millions. Like, I'll get this a lot. Like, people want to work with me on their books, and they'll say, you know, this book is going to sell Like, I want to write a book and I want it to sell. I talked to this guy recently. He's like, and my goal is to sell 2 million copies. And I, to me, this is a huge red flag.
Yeah.
Because he picked a sales goal, which was completely arbitrary, right? And I knew this. So I asked him, it was like, you know, why 2 million? And it was like, we'd heard that some other book had sold a million copies. And so he's like, oh, I'll double it. But it was like, who has a sales goal for something that they haven't even made yet, right? Yeah. So you're completely confusing the end state with the things that you need to do even to have a shot at potentially getting there. And you're assuming that something like the sales numbers are entirely in your control, which they're not, right? So I think instead, I do agree that we should be heads down and working on what we're supposed to be working on. What I take issue with is this idea that we should have these ambitious goals. We should be sort of whipping ourselves until we get them. And to me, this is self-absorption. And instead, I like to sort of start on a very small level. I find the flow state comes from being in the present moment and just focusing on making great work. And also, I mean, this is something I've been thinking about more recently, is like, consciously enjoying what you're doing is part of it too. Yeah, you know, if
God forbid, Ryan, like we actually enjoy any of the days that we spend to get to these end goals, right? I mean, back to your football analogy, if they're only happy when they win at the end of the season and every single play is just miserable, right?
Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you find the more you are enjoying it, the better you're going to do and the looser you're going to be. And there's a wonderful book called The Inner Game of Tennis. He's basically saying the more you're focused on hitting the ball really hard, the worse you're going to do. You sort of got to get out of your own way. So, yeah, I think consciously enjoying what you're doing and focusing on doing it really, really well, rather than sort of benchmarking every decision or choice you make against some goal, which is very far off in the distant future and by no means guaranteed, is a bad way to do it.
100%. I just love that you're coming out and saying this as somebody who has come out of the gate and done so much so young. This is a message that I'm sort of obsessed with. But here's something that I've been thinking about lately, and I wanted to hear your thoughts.
Yeah.
You talked about, you know, at the beginning, and I was like this, that you never imagine saying no, because part of my success was like, yes, 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 I'll do anything. Like my customers would call, yes, 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 right? And I do believe there's a certain amount of just, you know, suck it up when your clients at the beginning are asking for crazy things and give them 3 hours, not 2 hours, like really just get it done, you know, do a great job. And from there, it'll build and build and build. But right, like you have to start saying no at some point.
Sure.
How do you, like if an entrepreneur is out there, somebody who's trying to get going, it's so important to not say yes to everything. You'll burn out so much. But where's that line in starting, getting yourself going, being ambitious, and then, you know, risking that system of,
yeah,
you know, I don't know how to say no now, sort of kicks you in the ass eventually.
Yeah, so I definitely don't know where the line is. I think you tend to find it after you've passed it. You know, I'm not sure it's in some ways, I don't even know if you want to be advising people to sort of be pulling back before they get there, because you don't actually know what you're sort of, you don't know what your comfort zone or what you're capable of until maybe you've taken on a little bit more than you can bear. And you go, okay, here's the line, I'm going to scale this back. But
that's,
I agree.
Good point, like finding your own personal boundary. It's a little different for each person.
Yeah. But I agree. I think early on when you're sort of a striver, the only way you become successful is by saying yes to every single thing that you're given and, you know, sort of insisting on knocking it out of the park each time. But I'll tell you, so as a writer, I realized this, it was like, I tend to write more than most writers. I tend to produce quite a bit. And it occurred to me one day, you know, so I'm turning 30 this year. And, you know, I've done 5 books in the last 5 years. Wow. And I actually have more coming. But I realized it was like, okay, this is what I want to do. This isn't like a way station on the, you know, path to something else, or, you know, I don't just have this one series in me and I'm trying to get this series out. This is what I want to do. So, you know, the writers I admire, some of them are still writing and they're 80 years old. And so if I want to do this till I'm 80, this is not at all a sustainable pace. And
You have 80 books.
Yeah, right. That's absurd. And so at a certain point, you have to go, okay, what am I trying to accomplish? What does this look like in the long term? And how do I make sure that I'm keeping a sustainable pace? You know, I think strategically, if you're saying it early on in your career, you're saying yes to everything because you're trying to get your shot. Well, once you kind of have had your shot or you've established yourself, as you become more successful, you get even more opportunities, and right. they're not all good opportunities.
Right, right.
So what you have to cultivate is a sense of, you know, what's a good opportunity versus a bad opportunity? What's the difference between a pretty good opportunity and a really good opportunity? And what are the ones that are getting you closer to the life that you want to have? You know, I think I've said this before, but like one of the hardest things I think it is, at least for me, but I tend to find this is relatable. If someone is offering you money to do something, it's very hard for you to say like, no, I don't want that. Right? You can always squeeze in making more money. So right. saying it's a very first world problem, but saying no to paying opportunities is extraordinarily difficult. But that's the only way you're going to clear space to pursue some big or, you know, potentially even more lucrative opportunity. So it's like, for instance, as an author, if I'm saying yes to every speaking gig that comes my way, I'm going to be on the road all the time and I'm not going to have any time to write my next book. Right. So it becomes sort of strategically counterproductive to say yes to everything. If you're on the phone for 3 hours with every customer, that business isn't going to scale. And the customers that you're not on the phone with are going to feel like they're not getting special treatment. So it's a balance, and you have to learn how to say no, or you're going to jeopardize everything that you have already built.
Yeah. And I think this is a place where I get phone calls from really successful people who are struggling to find any happiness or joy or contentment because it's imploding within them, right? So I'm hearing that you say that's interesting in there is you have to start making those decisions. But how do you make those decisions? I feel it has to come from starting to really learn what you really want when there's a lot of opportunity, right? So if you have several options in front of you and your modus operandi for working in life has been to get to the next level, get the achievements. Now it's a question, what do I want, right? How do you suggest people start to think about that question?
Yeah, look, it's an essential question because if you don't know what you want, you can't make any strategic decisions, right? Because all opportunities are essentially equal, and that's a bad position to be in. I would say the other thing is sort of money. Like money is typically a very bad sort of metric as well, right? Because most people, even people who want lots of money, you ask them, and Tim Ferriss has talked about this a lot, you ask them why they want money. And it's usually to do something. And sometimes there are other, it's to do or to have something. And sometimes those things are easier to get than by earning more money. So I like to think about it as like, what does an ideal day of my life look like, right? Like, what do I want a day of my life to look like? And obviously, so for some people, it might be, okay, the ideal day of my life is to do nothing. I don't want to do anything, which is totally legitimate. And so in that case, you probably need to work really hard and create some sort of wealth or engine or whatever that you have to basically do the opposite of what you want right now. So then you can do only what you want in the future.
Uh-huh,
The other way to do it is to set up some sort of lifestyle that's maybe a little bit more sustainable or self-propagating, where you more or less get to do what you want every single day, but you have to do it, you know, more often. So that was something I thought about a lot. You know, do I want to build a business that scales, that I then sell, that then allows me to, you know, sort of write full time or retire or whatever? Or is it that I would rather sort of create a life on a day-to-day level that I'm more happy with that involves a little bit of this kind of work and a little bit of that kind of work that I think is perhaps a little bit more sustainable over time? So I think one way to think about it is just like, what does the day of my life look like? Or what is someone who has the life I want, what does their day look like?
Yeah.
And sort of you can kind of reverse engineer it a little bit from there.
Yeah, no, that's really great advice. And it keeps iterating, right? Because what you
sure.
want in one decade isn't what you want in the next decade. And you have to keep at that because, you know, things shift. You have children, different goals, you have different interests. And so that's such a great process to keep going through. But you talk specifically about passion, which I love. because I like got into this world and I was on the internet and I'm like, oh my God, if one more person says find your passion and you'll be happy, I'm like, you have to work your butt off. Passion isn't enough. Like unless like you're a passionate painter and you don't mind being broke in a one bedroom the rest of your life, like that's an option if that's what you're interested in. But tell me about why you talk about, you know, don't follow just passion and ultimately it's about purpose. What is that?
Yeah. I mean, look, I just think it's really superficial cliche advice to just tell someone to find their passion.
Yeah.
You know, I think first off, that's not great business advice. I tend to find that what you actually want is you want sort of, you know, overlapping Venn diagrams. It's like you want what you're good at, what you're really interested in or what you're passionate about. And then the third circle has to be what people are willing to pay you for, right? If you have to make a living on it. And so yeah. I think, you know, oftentimes people will just pursue something they're really passionate about and they haven't given much in the way of thought to how will this work? You know, what will this actually look like over the course of a lifetime? You know, is pure excitement about something sufficient to make a career or a life around it? That's not usually the case. And look, if you go back historically, you know, in philosophy, the passions were considered bad things. These were extreme emotions that had sort of debilitating, nasty effects on people. And so that's greed and lust and, yeah, you know, anger. These are what the passions really were. So it's sort of a perversion of that word in the English language anyway. So I like to say it's sort of purpose is passion that you sort of harnessed and put into some direction. And I guess another way to flip this passion discussion is like, I don't want to hire people that are like, if I'm deciding between two people and one's super passionate, but one's technically skilled or eminently qualified for the position, obviously I'm going to go with the latter, not the former. Passion is insufficient. Obviously, if you hate what you're doing and you're not interested in it, you're not going to be very good at it.
Right.
But, you know, just because you love something is not going to be, is not the, that's not the deciding variable, you know, between becoming a professional athlete and not becoming a professional athlete does not come down to how much do you like basketball, right? Or how passionate you are about basketball. That's not the critical variable.
Right. And so you say in your book, talent is only the starting point. Right?
Yes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have our talents and passion for that talent is great, but I think you've got to work really hard in pursuit of those talents and then deal with the realities of the world that those talents might need to be tweaked a little so that people are actually interested in it. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, you don't want to be so blinded by your passion that you can't see your own strengths and weaknesses, that you can't see how your work is landing with other people, that you can't sort of step back and from a distance decide the best path, you know, for something. And so I think passion tends to be blinding. I think purpose, on the other hand, allows people to persevere and sort of overcome immense obstacles.
And why does purpose allow you to overcome obstacles?
Well, because something stands in your way, but you have some larger purpose, yeah, either you're going to find some way around this obstacle or you're going to commit yourself like, I don't care, nothing is going to hold me back from getting through this thing. I actually tend to find that the problem with passion is that it thinks that its excitement is sufficient, right? So it goes, oh, I want this. Of course it's going to be easy. And then it isn't easy. And then that's where it starts to peter out. You know, I forget who said it, but, you know, a gun is an explosion directed in a singular direction. It's a directed explosion. You know, passion is the explosion. Purpose is, you know, the explosion down a gun barrel.
Because when you start to follow the passion, the talent, the purpose, and you're working really hard, it is difficult to get these things out into the world, right? Like,
of course.
I mean, I think that secret like book that came out, just find what you love and the world manifests it back to you.
Sure.
No?
No, not at all. Look, the world is at best indifferent to you, right? The world at its most kind is not going to get in your way and prevent you from doing the things that you want to do. So wanting something is not enough. I say this to authors, like they'll go, I want to write a book. And I say, you know, wanting is not enough. It's that you have to write this book, that you can't not do it. And so to me, that's purpose, right? So it's like, hey, I want to write a book because someone said I should write a book. Really bad reason. You know, I want to be a model because someone said I should be a model. Really bad reason. I want to be a lawyer because somebody told me that I'm good at arguing, or I want to be a lawyer because I'm good at arguing. Also, really bad reason. But I want to be a lawyer because this is what I think I can accomplish through the law. Great reason. I want to write this book because I feel like it's something that no one has said and it has the potential to improve people's lives. Or I want to be a model because that's what makes, you know, that's where I feel good and powerful. And I feel like I have a personality and a skill and a look that's, you know, unique and special. And I work hard and I'm not going to quit. These are reasons to pursue those things, not, oh, I like it. I think it would be fun.
Right. And I feel passionate and the universe is going to conspire to help me. And I think when you are passionate about something and you start creating and you start putting yourself out there, there is a way in which, you know, people respond to that and sure. It starts to have traction, but it is about getting out there, taking action, not just sitting totally. Around in a self-centered passion state.
Yeah, so, of course. Like I hear from so many people, they've sort of planned it all out, right? They know, it's like, they know what they're going to say when they're accepting their Oscar on stage, but they aren't actually doing anything. And so that's where I think passion tends to, you know, basically be sort of a form of masturbation.
Totally. And so then you're out there, you're working and fear kicks in. And ego and all this stuff, and it's hard and you're not getting the results you're looking for, and you wrote a book that you like, but like people aren't liking it as much and marketing's harder and like all these different things, whatever business you're in, whatever world you're in, whether, you know, you're a professor, whether you're in a business environment, humility is something you talk about and letting go of ego and coming into a space of humility, which is something that really resonates with me as well. Talk to me a little bit about humility in this process.
Yeah. You know, I think we tend to associate creative people with, you know, huge egos. And I'm not sure that that's the right way. I think when you actually meet really, really talented people, they tend to be very humble. And they're humble because they know either they've only managed to achieve a fraction of what they know that they might be capable of achieving or that they're trying to achieve. Or I remember I had lunch with Stephen Pressfield, who wrote this book, The War of Art, a few years ago.
Great.
And I was, and so to me, he's like sort of accomplished all of the things that an author can accomplish. And I remember I said something that's like, you know, your books have sold like so many copies. This is amazing. And it's objectively true. They have. But he like immediately replied, he's like, oh, but they haven't sold nearly as many copies as, you know, X, Y, and Z. Right. And he wasn't saying it like he was ambitiously comparing himself to them. He was finding a way that the success that he had would not go to his head. And like the last thing you want to be doing as an artist is sitting there thinking like, I'm so great. Look at all the things that I've done. That's like a recipe for not doing any more great things.
Yeah. And it's not the metrics to really assess a meaningful life. It's the value you've contributed, right? Like it's ultimately the goal, not how many books I sold, but the books I sold and people read it and they got value, right? Like I read that book of his and it really helped me.
Sure. And look, obviously that recipe for humility is really important when you're successful because it's what allows you to continue to do what you do rather than sort of becoming a sort of a toxic asshole. Right. At the same time, you know, what if Stephen Pressfield's books had not sold well? Right? They were misunderstood or there was some backlash or trend against them. If his metric for success was like, oh, look how many copies I've sold, that would also be devastating and would prevent him from being successful. So it's like, if you think your success says something about you as a person, you're not going to be more successful in the future. But if you think your failure says something about you as a person, or if you think a lack of critical reception or accolades or sales or whatever also says something about you as a person, that's really terrible too. Because now you listen, you go, I am a piece of shit, right? Like I do suck. The world does hate me. I am worthless. So really you have to find, I think what humility does is it's finding something different to value, right? It's saying, you know, this is good because I worked really hard on it and I hope you like it. And if you don't like it, that's okay. But I think that you would, or I think you'll come around to it. It's a much more resilient attitude.
Yeah, Brian, it's so true. And when I talk to entrepreneurs about my business, we worked really, really hard. And there was this serendipitous moment where it popped, but it also could have not happened. And then when we sold our company, I had actually set up my whole life to take a break because I was pregnant and I was going to just coast for a little bit. My company was like in perfect state to just take some time. And somebody called to purchase our company. Like, never would have called that in a million years, had no idea that that was coming. So there's a serendipitous quality to those bumps in success too, that aren't necessarily of your doing or your making. It's just, they happen. And so doing great work can lead to great success, but it can also, the road could have turned for me in other directions and those things didn't happen.
Yeah. And look, I think you want to be on sort of aware or on watch for the kind of arrogance that can take those sort of fortuitous bumps and say, oh, this says something about me as a person, because what about the next time where you don't get that, right? You start another company and it doesn't break that way. And it takes long, like you're like, if you assume that what happened to you is entirely earned all the time.
Yeah.
Well, what happens when you do everything right? You know, like we were talking about Nick Saban, you know, the national championship game was on Monday. You know, they lost, they led the whole game and they lost with 1 second left. You know, you lose the last national championship with 1 second left. If your decision on how, if your view of how you played that game is determined by the fact that, you know, this pass was completed, or this, you know, that this player made this uncatchable catch, you're setting yourself up to be crushed by things that are totally outside of your control. And then it's harder for you to recover and do well the next year.
Great, great, great point. Because if you take credit for the successes as 100% you, then the failures are 100% you, and then you can be devastated by those losses. Yeah. Yeah, great point. And, you know, look, I've done this book and I had a friend who was, I talked about this early on, but she worked at Oprah and she's like, oh girl, this is going to be on Oprah. And because of my experience, I was like, I don't want to hear that. It's going to get in my head. And it did get in my, and it drove me nuts. I'm like, oh my God, why'd you have to say that to me? It put pressure. And of course I didn't get on Oprah with the first book out of the gate, right? Like, that would be crazy. So I think that stuff, it's so important to manage, whether it's positive or negative. So
completely.
Ryan, everybody who comes on the show, the book, this podcast is about authenticity and having a life that is meaningful and successful. We're talking about this stuff at length, but ultimately for you, what does an authentic life mean to you then?
Yeah, I don't totally know what the word authentic means. You know, I don't know what my definition is there. I know that the life that I sort of wanted was that I wanted to wake up, and this is sort of my vague sort of goal that I were. It's like I wanted to be able to wake up, and when I had sort of creative thoughts or things that I wanted to make, I would have access to an audience to sort of distribute those ideas. So that was sort of part one of my plan. And then the other part, and you sort of hinted at some of this stuff, is like, I didn't want to be some person who was sort of so obsessed or addicted to their work that their sort of value as a human being rises and falls on it. So, you know, I think equally important to me is my personal life. I want to be married. I want to have kids that, you know, are not raised to be monsters. And I want to live where I want to live. I want to have the schedule that I want to have. What I really don't like doing is anything that I don't want to do, right? Like, so completely. So, you know, and I'll catch myself all the time. I'll have a day where I did like 20 things that I didn't want, you know, it's like I agreed to this, you know, interview, and then I went to this meeting that I didn't, you know, I couldn't say no. I felt like I couldn't say no to. And then, you know, this happened and this happened, and I go, you know, this was intense. entirely in my control. I consented to all these things.
Yeah.
And that's not the life that I want. And then I make sort of decisions and changes around that. But it's like, I think, and this goes back to what we were saying earlier, if you have a good sense of what you want a day in your life to look like, it allows you to sort of decide as you're going forward, like, how close am I to that, right?
Yes. And I love hearing you say that because, again, I work with people who are not particularly happy with maybe where they're at or their careers or the choices or the days they're having. And then they think, well, if I get this clear, then I'll have days that I love every day, no matter what.
Yeah.
And I sadly thought that too. I thought, oh, when I start to just build a life that is every day what I want, then I'll just be there. It's not an island. You don't land on it. And it's not like I get to stay there. It's micro choices all the time that remain integral to what you want. And trying to do that is difficult, right? And you
totally.
Sometimes you make good choices and sometimes you don't. And sometimes the days suck, but it's coming back is what I'm hearing you say, right? To the intention.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I think a lot of people think like, oh, if I only worked from home, I would be happy. Or if I only, you know, had $1 million, I would be happy. Or if I only got a book published, I'd be happy. Or, you know, whatever it is. And it's like, actually, no. And a lot of those things are kind of out of your control. So it's really, it's like, what do I feel happy doing? And what is sort of a drain on my soul? And so for me, it's like, when I'm doing like pointless meetings, or, you know, I'm doing work that I don't think I'll be proud of when it's completed, these are the kinds of things that I am really unhappy when I'm doing. And so it's like, I've tried to attune my radar as much as possible to like the decisions or choices that get me in those messes. Like I had an opportunity a couple months ago, like a really big tech company wanted me to come be like an in-house consultant for like 3 months. They were going to pay a ton of money and I would have to live in New York. And it was like, on the one hand, I like money and I like working on cool projects. On the other hand, it takes me away from the city. Like, I hate New York. So I'm not going to live in my house, which I like. I'm not going to be writing because I'll have sold my time to this other company. I'll be a consultant. So I won't actually have any control over any of the things that are happening. I'll just be giving ideas, which tends to be discouraging. And so, yes, on the one hand, it would be an impressive thing to do and it would look good on my resume and I might make me seem important, but I would be deeply unhappy doing it. So I have to say no. Yeah. And, you know, I remember when they asked me, I pursued it and I talked through it and I probably wasted time even considering this thing. And then at a certain point, I was like, okay, I've been down this road before. I know where this goes. Now I have to back up and not go any further in this direction. And you know, I give myself credit every time I catch myself doing something like that and sort of going back to the path that I actually want to be on.
So Ryan, let me just ask you a sub point to that, because I love that you're saying it, but for people out there that are struggling to make those decisions that they want to make, how do you know? So you go down the path, the money's out there, you recognize, okay, wait, it's not about money, fame, fortune, it's like good on my credentials. But then you said you sat back and you said, oh, I've been here before. Where is the here? Like, is it, you feel it in your body? Is it like a, how do you know that it's a no?
Well, so it's like, I've said yes to that decision. When I say I've been here before, it's like, I've said yes to that exact opportunity before. And in many ways, it led to the intro of Ego is the Enemy, right? Like, it's like, wait, there are a lot of similarities here to the last time I said yes to one of these opportunities. And I know how that ended up. It's like, I do think you want to say yes to lots of things, because that's how I'll give you this. So for a big portion of my life, I can work really hard and I tend to be able to manage a lot of things simultaneously. So for almost my entire 20s, I could say yes to everything and not have to, like, I could add something to my sort of my burden and not have to get rid of anything else to balance it out. I could just say yes and yes and yes. And so, you know, I started to think at some point, like, maybe I can just literally do an unlimited amount, right? Like, I could, it's an unlimited amount. And eventually I got to a point where I was like, oh, nope, I'm a human being. My capacities are finite. And about right here is where the wheels start to get really shaky and the whole thing might collapse. And so, you know, thankfully with the American Apparel stuff, I was able to pull back sort of right at that edge. I could have gone over probably, but like, I wouldn't have learned that if I didn't say yes. So it's sort of getting a sense of, it's like you and your body kind of know how fast you could run a mile or how many miles you could run, or you know sort of intuitively how much weight you could pick up. And one of the ways you get stronger, obviously, is by incrementally increasing that amount, or at certain points dramatically increasing that amount for, like, you know, a one rep max or whatever. Yeah. But you do have to know, okay, this is my threshold. Yeah. And it starts to get dangerous about around that threshold.
Yeah, it's so much easier with our bodies because you reach down for that weight and you just physically can't lift it. And I joke, I wish we had like narcoleptic attacks where we just, our brains just like turn off like a computer, you know, like, it would just be so much easier if we just couldn't do it. Yeah.
Yes. No, completely. But I also think it's important to have other things in your life that are important to you that you can see when they suffer. So for instance, like, I love writing. I love reading. You know, exercise is really important to me. My relationship with my wife is really important to me. So it's like, and obviously my work is important to me. It's like, I have a good sense of what the balance of all those things is, where I'm getting to do enough of all those things that I feel good.
Yeah.
And so if it's like, oh, wait, I haven't read any books in a while. It's like, oh, I've probably started to overcommit in one area. It's like you're juggling all these balls and the spacing is really important. And if the spacing gets messed up, the whole thing collapses. So you gotta know.
You gotta just keep navigating. And so what are some of the habits that you have on a daily basis to help you continuously navigate? Do you, I mean, sort of more on the practical, right? Do you have like lists that you make? Do you have Monday mornings? Like what do you do to look at all of the balls in the air and keep assessing what's working, not working?
Yes, I have three things I try to do. So every day I try to do some kind of walk, which I don't consider to be exercise. I consider it to be some sort of kind of a meditative exercise. Okay. I do some strenuous form of exercise, whether it's running or swimming or, you know, sort of weights or something like that. And then I try to read every day. So I try to have these three things, which I think are important in my personal sanity. And so I know if I'm not doing those things, something's wrong.
Yep.
I also try to keep a really short to-do list. So like maybe I think my to-do list today has four items on it. One is really small, one is kind of big, you know, and then I try to schedule as few things as, like, I'm just really, I have like, you know, anorexia, calendar anorexia, right? Like I just want to put as few things in my calendar as possible. So like as much blank space in my calendar as possible is a sign that I have as much freedom as possible. So if I look at my calendar, if my calendar is packed, then that's a bad sign.
Very cool. I love that. I love the short list. People love their list. They love to have 50 deep and then have panic attacks over it.
Totally.
Yeah. You can't do more than four or five things in a day.
Sure. And look, five things is easy to do, right? So if I do these five things, like that day is successful.
And you practice noticing the successes, right? Instead of worrying about the 30 things you didn't do.
Yeah, no, I take pleasure in ripping up the to-do list at the end of the day after all the items.
I love it. Ryan, love chatting with you. Love this topic. Love everything you're working on. It's so powerful and helpful and meaningful. And I think everybody listening will get a ton of value. If they're interested in your book, they can find it on Amazon. They have several books, as you mentioned, one a year. So there's plenty to check out. And you can also find Ryan at ryanholiday.net, right? Is that the...
Yep.
Am I giving the right information? Awesome.
Correct.
Thank you so much for sharing your time and your work with us today.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Hey, before you go, I have a quick question for you. Have you ever considered coaching? If you have no idea what coaching is, no worries. It's basically like a personalized workout program, but instead of doing 100 squats and a million sit-ups, you're working out your mind, your well-being, and your emotions. Coaching is about setting goals and taking action to create a life that's meaningful to you. As we navigate through life and ask ourselves the tough questions, what do I want? What makes me happy? How do I build a life that works for me? Just like we talk about on the podcast, how do I have success, but have success that's authentic and meaningful? In part, the tactics play a huge role. Setting goals, having priorities that make sense, and making sure you're organized with your lists. After running a company for 15 years, I help my clients with that all the time. But coaching takes it even further. We remove all that stuff, all those mental obstacles that get in your way when you're trying to make those tough life choices. If that sounds interesting to you, come on over to lauraco.com, click on the contact form and send me a note, or at the bottom of the homepage, you'll see a button where you can click and set up a call with me. Just like that, it's free. We'll chat, we'll find out what's going on and see if it makes sense for me to help you out. No strings attached. I hope to hear from you. And again, thank you so much for tuning in. I really value each and every one of you.